Let me, I guess there is a, the queue at the restroom is long. I think there's also downstairs in the basement, in the at the subway shop.
It's on the first floor.
On the first floor?
Yeah.
Let me just make, I'll make just a few comments that cover some of the ideas in the lecture notes that are online for this class. Just things that I want to really emphasize. The first has to do with a contrast I draw between the following two ways of characterizing the intellectual domain of the course. One is the Marxist tradition, one way of referring to it, and the other is Marxism. Now, I prefer the term the Marxist tradition to Marxism. Marx himself famously at one point said in French, "Je ne suis pas un Marxiste," I'm not a Marxist. Now, what he meant by that was not that he was repudiating his life's work. What he meant is that he was uncomfortable with being identified with a doctrine that had become an ism, that had become viewed as a body of work with closed boundaries to it. Now, ultimately, of course, the key issue is the content of the ideas, the soundness of the argument, their capacity to deepen our understanding. So the real issue is not the label you use. Nevertheless, I think there's a certain liability in this intellectual tradition that comes from its overly close identification with the founding theorist of the tradition. And the analogy I like to draw is with the relationship between Darwin to evolutionary biology. Most evolutionary biologists have very fond feelings about Darwin. They would argue that many of their ideas have roots in Darwin's own work. But they don't call themselves Darwinists. The intellectual current, if you want to call it that, that uses the term Darwinism are anti-evolutionists. Creationists like to talk about evolutionary biology as Darwinism. And what they want to do is reduce it to a dogma, to a doctrine, rather than to a body of theoretical ideas that identify real causal processes in the world and attempt to theorize them abstractly. Calling Marxism Marxism, I think, risks turning it into the exegesis of text, making arguments by citing passages in Marx, and discrediting arguments by showing that they are a misinterpretation of Marx. Now, I think Marx's own work is extraordinary. It's as grand and powerful and interesting a body of work that anybody has ever produced in the social sciences and social theory. It's an extraordinary, interesting, rich body of work. I have no objections whatsoever to people studying Marx and his own work. I think it's a valuable thing to do. But I don't think we should feel any deference to it. It shouldn't have any primal standing. Indeed, you know, if you really think about it, it's a sign of the failure of this intellectual tradition if it remains the case 150 years after it was first written that the best thing on any given topic is things that Marx wrote. Right, so Darwin wrote fantastic things about the evolution of species, but it is not the case that the best thing ever written about evolution was written 150 years ago. It's in a science, even a social science, where the word science has to be put in some kind of quotation marks because of the ambiguities as to the scientificity of social science. But nevertheless, it's a sign of failure that if it's the case, that the very best thing that got it right, as best as we can know, was written 150 years ago. Now, much of what Marx wrote, I think, is right. I don't think that it's that everything he wrote is flawed. I just don't think, in general, it's the case that the best thing you can read on ideology was written by Marx or Marx and Engels, that the best thing you can read about class was written by Marx, that the best thing you can read about the state was written by Marx. And that's one of the reasons why mostly we don't read Marx in this class. I didn't sense from when everyone introduced themselves that they mainly wanted to study Marx per se. But if that's the case, this isn't a proper class, because this class is going to be on the ideas of this tradition, in which for each topic I try to identify what I think are the most interesting, analytically rigorous, clear, debatable pieces of, discussable pieces of work. All right, so that's the first point, the Marxist tradition versus Marxism. In spite of that, I use the term Marxism all the time. The world has christened this tradition Marxism, and it's being a little precious to refuse to ever utter the expression Marxism just because you think it has certain creepy aspects to it. So I don't monitor that usage that carefully. By the way, today especially, normally since we're going to have a class where we have punchy, hopefully, 30 minute presentation, it's probably better for me just to do that without a lot of questions and interruptions, because we'll have plenty of time for discussion. But today, given the oddness of this first class, if anybody wants to interject some pithy comment or raise an issue with anything I'm saying today, don't hesitate, just raise your hand and we can have some discussion as I present these points from the lecture. Okay, that's my first thing I just wanted to mention. It follows, of course, from the idea that this course is about the core ideas, theories, and problems in the Marxist tradition. Using the word tradition, that there are actually many different currents of thought within that tradition. I don't think the Marxist tradition should be viewed as paradigmatic, that is, as a closed, fully formed paradigm in which you can clearly identify someone who's working within it and without. There's lots of currents in this tradition. They often shed more blood fighting with each other than they do with theoretical ideas that are alien to that tradition. And I take an extremely pluralistic view towards these. I am of the Let a Thousand Flowers Bloom school of intellectual work. I think insights are really hard to gain, and I'm happy for people to be Hegelian Marxists, to be critical theorists, to be analytical Marxists, to be material deterministic anti-subject Marxist, the whole bit. Any of these traditions, I think, have interesting things to say, that there are people are struggling with to find insights. The one kind of work that I'm pretty intolerant of is work that I feel is dishonest, or what I like to call bullshit Marxism. You know, basically, when people are just announcing doctrinal formulas without any attention to the underlying arguments, and particularly when they know better. You know, there are various writers who I know better than what they write, and that they are basically waving their hands over problems because they want to make a polemical point of some sort. So I get impatient with what I call intellectual bullshit. If you Google the words bullshit and Jerry Cohen, who's an anti-bullshit artist, there's a technical philosophical discussion of the concept of bullshit and what it means intellectually. And it's basically about a certain kind of intellectual dishonesty.
Harry Frankfurt.
Harry Frankfurt, exactly. He wrote that book,
right.
Bullshit.
Yeah.
The importance of what we care about, anthology.
Just as a biographical anecdote, I've been deeply engaged in a circle of Marxist work, although not everybody involved in this is at this point in history still Marxist, that began in the late 70s, triggered by Jerry Cohen's book, Karl Marx's Theory of History and Defense, which we'll read at the end of the semester. And the group called its internal name. It's been meeting now for 30 years. We're having our 30th meeting at the beginning of October. Basically the same group of people. It calls itself the NBSMG, the Non-Bullshit Marxism Group. The only people in the group who still identify their work with Marxism as such is myself and Robert Brenner. Everyone else has sort of drifted off into other self-identifications, although the central preoccupations of the group haven't changed that much. Let me make some comments about this issue of critical emancipatory social science. As in the lecture notes, I announce that this particular course and the body of ideas that we'll be discussing fall within a broader umbrella that we could call emancipatory social science, or to add an additional word which may be somewhat redundant, critical emancipatory social science. Let me just say a couple of comments to highlight some things you might want to think about in that language. First, the notion of critical theory. There are many different ways you can that expression critical theory has been elaborated. I'm not meaning to give you some authoritative definition of the word critical within that expression, critical theory. But here's one way that I think it's useful. And this is also giving you some armory to deal with mainstream sociology, people who may be skeptical of this kind of work. I like to think of social theory and social science as facing the following choice. When you study things in the world, you can restrict your arguments and analysis to the range of variations that you can see in the world. So, for example, if you're studying gender relations, you can say, well, what does it mean to study gender? It means to study the variations that we observe in the world in the social relations between men and women, to give a kind of crude account. You limit your analysis to the range of variation that's observable, that has actually occurred empirically. Now, if you do that, then the notion of gender equality falls outside of the range of variation that you observe in the world. Or take class. If you're studying class, you can study the range of variation that you observe in the world. The idea of classlessness, at least in kind of economically developed context of the world, would cease to be a relevant theoretical category. Right? So one idea is you limit yourself to variations that actually occur. Let's call that, again, this is not a technically sound use of the term, but let's call that empiricist social science. Empiricism as a philosophical doctrine has lots of other stuff with it. But I'm not pegging this to the grand philosophical meaning of empiricism, although I think this is consistent with that. So we're going to study inequality. Empiricist research on class will say, you're only given permission to study the variations that exist in the world. So the extreme variations in the developed economies are between Sweden and the United States. These are the kind of outlier. They define the limits of variation. The United States has the highest levels of economic inequality of developed economies. Sweden has the lowest. Finland probably is lower now, but Sweden is the icon of the low end. And you try to explain and understand that variation. A critical theorist rejects the constraint that we can only theorize the observable variations and says there are other values on the variation of class that we really care about. And in particular, we care about classlessness. A classless society is an important form of variation on the variable class. I'm using this language of variation and variable in order to sharpen this contrast. It's not that you have to use that language to describe this. I think the key idea of a critical theory is that it posits forms of variation outside of the empirically actual limits of variation as things we can study and theorize about and get ideas about from empirical observation. Critical theory doesn't imply that you don't observe the world, but that you don't restrict your theoretical arguments to the observable. And in the Marxian context, the notion that you study capitalism from the vantage point of its transcendence, of going beyond capitalism, with the idea of classlessness as the, at least the normative anchor for that variation beyond capitalism, that becomes the centerpiece for the analysis of capitalism itself. Capitalism is analyzed from the point of view of an alternative to capitalism, and that's why it's seen as a critique of capitalism. It's also then a critique of theories of capitalism, so critical in critical theory is a double meaning. It's a critique of theories of capitalism that don't involve variations beyond the possibilities of capitalism. It's a critique of standard political economy in Marx's time. It's a critique of standard economic sociology in the current time, that it does not contain categories beyond the limits of variation of what we observe. Now, emancipatory puts something more positive in the notion of critique. It puts some real content in it. It says that we want to analyze the existing world not with respect to any possible, any old alternative that lies outside of the limits of variation we can observe, but rather we particularly are interested in studying the existing world from the point of view of emancipatory alternatives. That's the, in this expression, emancipatory social science, the most controversial word is the word emancipatory. I mean, there's plenty of controversies about the science bit, which I'm sure some of you are well tuned into. And I can make comments about that as well. There's some controversies around the social part. What do we really mean by social? We'll be discussing some of that when we discuss methodological individualism, when we deal with those issues of micro, macro, the question of what is the social does become important. But I think the real controversies around these ideas come from the emancipatory part. Let me just define what I'm talking about when I say emancipatory social science, and then say a few words about emancipatory, about that word. So I'm just going to read the definition that I have presented. This is in the notes, I think. And this is the definition that comes out. This is in my book, Envisioning Real Utopias, in the introductory chapter, What is Emancipatory, or the Tasks of Emancipatory Social Science. Emancipatory social science seeks to generate scientific knowledge relevant to the collective project of challenging various forms of human oppression. To call it a form of social science rather than simply social criticism or social philosophy implies that it recognizes the importance of systematic scientific knowledge about how the world works for this task. To call it emancipatory is to identify a central moral purpose for the production of knowledge, the elimination of oppression and the creation of the conditions for human flourishing. That's what it means to call it emancipatory, that the purpose for producing knowledge is not simply curiosity, which is a perfectly legitimate reason to produce knowledge, but the purpose for producing knowledge in an emancipatory social science is to contribute to the elimination of oppression and the creation of the conditions for human flourishing. And to call it social implies the belief that human emancipation depends upon the transformation of the social world, not just the inner life of persons. So an emancipatory social science does not imply a rejection of the view that the transformation of the inner life of persons is irrelevant. It doesn't even say that in a kind of Buddhist sense, inner enlightenment is an aspect of emancipation and is a good thing in its own right. It's not condemning inner enlightenment. It just says it's not sufficient to have inner enlightenment if we wish to challenge oppression and create universal conditions for human flourishing. And that's why a social account is needed. That is, that the obstacles to eliminating oppression and creating the conditions for human flourishing, the obstacles come from social relations, not just inner states. So that's what I mean by emancipatory social science. Now, the part of that that's the most fraught and difficult to really clarify and defend is the emancipatory part. And in particular, the couplet that I use in that expression, the elimination of oppression, and there's two parts to that. It's the elimination of oppression, or challenging oppression, and creating the conditions for human flourishing. The notion of creating the conditions for human flourishing turns out to be, when you really try to explain what you're talking about, filled with complexity and with challenge. Particularly in a world of cultural pluralism where there are many different conceptions of what it means to live a good life. And if you want to stake out a notion of a challenge to the obstacles to human flourishing, it's very difficult to fully elaborate that without confronting some of these very difficult cultural questions. I think the idea of human flourishing is the moral core of the idea of human emancipation. In some sense, I think it's more fundamental than the notion of oppression. As oppression is the extreme case of the blocking of the possibilities of human flourishing. Oppression is a way of identifying a structure that's imposing harms on people. But harms are harms because of the way they obstruct human flourishing. And so I think, in a way, the human flourishing idea, however hard it is to define, is really the moral core. Nevertheless, I think it's useful to couple it with oppression and the opposition to oppression as a central driving force for this. There are a variety of other words that you could use besides flourishing. You could say well-being, to create the conditions for human well-being. Or you could say to create the conditions for human happiness. Another word we value. I mean, I think most people say it's better to be happy than unhappy. The American Declaration of Independence has the pursuit of happiness as one of the foundational impulses for a well-ordered republic. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. You could say the pursuit of flourishing, the pursuit of welfare, the pursuit of well-being. These are all terms that are tapping a similar domain. I prefer flourishing. It's the best I've been able to come up with as a way of thinking about these issues. I get a little queasy with happiness, you know, sort of smiley faces, kind of. And part of it is because I think human beings can be incredibly resilient. That we are good at what's called in the cognitive psychology field adaptive preference formation, where you lower your expectations to what's realistically possible in your lives. And furthermore, what we know from neuropsychological research is that a lot of variation between people in how happy they are depends upon endorphins and neurotransmitters and things which would be otherwise called temperament. That, you know, under the most oppressive and miserable conditions, there'll be some cheerful people. Because of the luck of the draw and the genetic lottery on neurotransmitters. So happiness to me seems an extremely vulnerable criterion for deciding whether social institutions are to be challenged or not, whether they're fundamentally flawed. And I think the notion of conditions for human flourishing has this more open-ended set of possibilities. I think it also is more open to an objective evaluation. If we think of human flourishing as meaning the realization of human potentials, it's easier to see that a person's potentials have been blocked, even if they're happy, personally. And to say, yes, this is a person who has been denied access to the necessary social and material conditions to develop their potentials. We can say that whether or not that person is unhappy as a result of that, because of the robustness of their temperament and the like. Therefore, I think that the moral core centers around flourishing. That's the best way of expressing it. And then this leads to a particular concept of social justice, which is elaborated at some length in the chapter. I think that chapter was assigned in this first session. It's, what is emancipatory social science? I think the title actually ended up being The Tasks of Emancipatory Social Science, and it ended up being chapter 2, but I think you probably figured that out by looking at it. This then underlies a particular concept of social justice. So I consider a socially just society as a society in which all people have equal access to the necessary material and social means to live a flourishing life. Equal access to both the social and material means. For what purpose? To live a flourishing life. Not the social and material means to be happy, or the social and material means necessary for human well-being. Well, that's not too bad, but I think to live a flourishing life ends up being the best way of formulating both the moral concern and the social justice idea that is rooted in that moral concern. An emancipatory social science, then, is a social science that produces knowledge about social institutions that are relevant to that moral task of challenging oppression, the harms that are imposed on human lives by our institutions, and contributing to creating the conditions for human flourishing. What other brief comments from this first set of readings? Let me make a comment about science, since that will come up at various times during the semester. In the Marxist tradition, I think there is a real tension. This is part of my debate with Michael Burovoy, which was in the readings. There's a real tension between two purposes that the body of ideas that we call Marxism serve. It's a tension between what I would describe as Marxism as ideology and Marxism as social science. And it's an inherent and inescapable tension. When Marxism functions as a revolutionary ideology, its purpose is to motivate and inspire people to action, and in particular, to create the kinds of commitments and solidarities needed for very long-term sacrifices for a transformative goal. That's what religions also do. One of the reasons why Islam functions effectively as a political mobilizing ideology in the present historical period is because religion has a capacity to mobilize a set of commitments, to make sacrifices for a long-term goal. And it creates a sense of confidence in people that they are acting in a way that is contributing to some big historical project. As ideology, a central task is to create confidence and certainty, not perpetual skepticism. But as science, a body of ideas, should cultivate skepticism, constant uncertainty about the foundations and security of one's knowledge, not certainty. An openness to critics who say, you got it wrong, and a capacity to learn from mistakes, to learn in a way that leads you to interrogate even core concepts. There should be no absolute commitment to the certainty of truth of any proposition within a scientific paradigm. Now, or framework, or method, or whatever you want to call it. Now, of course, there may be some things which seem so settled that you don't continually dispute them. In Darwin-based evolutionary biology, the idea that natural selection is one of the powerful forces shaping the direction of evolutionary development, that's a settled issue for most evolutionary biologists. Lots of other things are not settled, but that natural selection is one of the central forces is a settled issue. And within the Marxian tradition, there's some things which I think are rightfully settled issues. They've been debated enough, we've got enough evidence that we don't need to revisit them every day. But even the settled issues are not settled by virtue of their fidelity to some doctrine. They're settled because the weight of the evidence and the strength of the arguments means that it's a waste of time to keep debating them and get on to other things which are not settled. Science, therefore, requires skepticism. Ideology encourages certainty, a sense of certainty, and that's attention. And that's one of the reasons why I think the Marxist tradition has its particular character that no other theoretical tradition in social sciences has. You know, Weberians don't go to the wall defending a particular theoretical position because of its centrality to Weber's ideas. Even Parsonsian functionalists don't have that kind of bedrock foundational commitment to the... And even neoclassical economists, who are about as dogmatic as you can get, the current challenge to the foundations of neoclassical economists because of these new developments in what's called behavioral economics that are really shattering the whole rationality paradigm of neoclassical economics. Lots of neoclassical economists are saying, that's really interesting. And they may continue doing their old models because they are stuck, but mostly they are prepared to acknowledge that, yes, they are not on secure foundations. Well, that's attention. For purposes of this course and my own intellectual work, I am firmly on the sort of science versus ideology, on the science side of this tension. And that's not because I reject the notion that we need ideologies to motivate and inspire and create a willingness to sacrifice. If we're going to transform the world, if there's going to be social change of the sort that advance the prospects of universalizing the conditions of human flourishing, that's going to require ideologies that build solidarities and commitments. And I don't have a resolution to this tension. What I'm good at is, I think, cultivating the right kind of critical skepticism and analytical tools to advance our knowledge. I think that's as important. In order to change the world in the way we want, we must understand how it really works. Wishful thinking is a very powerful force in human history, and it leads people to engage in all sorts of transformative struggles in ways that end up being self-defeating. And one of the remedies to that, or counterweights to that, is the production of scientific knowledge about the problems which revolutionaries and transformative activists care about. Yeah.
So what would come first? Does one lead to the other? Does the other... they have a relationship with them?
I don't... I just think these are two bodies of... These are two ways that ideas function in social life. They function as ideologies with well-articulated connections that form cohesive poles in people's belief systems that enable them to engage in certain kinds of actions, which, in the absence of the ideology, they would find difficult to do. That's one of the things that human beings are capable of constructing, bodies of ideas that work that way. And scientific frameworks for identifying causal processes and constraints and possibilities is another way that ideas function. And in this particular cluster of ideas, the same words are used in both. And it causes difficulties for both. You know, I mean, the scientific practice gets mucked up by the strength of the ideological commitments. There's no question about it that there are times when people fail to understand the weaknesses of their own theory because of the strength of their ideological commitments. On the other hand, the science creates doubt that makes people less willing to engage in the hard struggles and sacrifices. They become burned out with worrying about these ideas. So I don't see a clean resolution of this. You know, the Enlightenment fantasy is that there was a clean resolution, that the truth will set you free. If you really understood the science and really understand how the world worked, that would also provide all the motivations you need. Well, I just don't think that's a good, that's not an adequate social psychology of social movements and how people think. Yeah, David, you
were Well, I was just going to say, I think Lakatos makes kind of an interesting point, which is that, like, so much of the history of science has come as a result of sort of like a hardcore of orthodox sort of like ideological, like an ideological base, and that those sort of like the initial assumptions or principles are never really questioned, and that's how some new developments are able to take place. So like in neoclassical economics, you don't see people like day to day challenging sort of like the base principles, and as a result, if you believe it, they're able to make a whole bunch of fairly interesting developments, and it requires that sort of dogma too.
But Lakatos also warns against what he calls a degenerate research program, where that core becomes strong and rigid in ways which block developments which might be inconsistent with the core, but which are necessary developments for the further advance of knowledge. And you can end up with a degenerative program. And in the Marxist context, this is fueled by its political connection. The core gets politically infused with a political project in the way that the core of evolutionary biology doesn't, or the core of physics doesn't. The core of neoclassical economics has some of that, but aren't prepared to die for neoclassical economics. They aren't prepared to die for Marxism. You know, and so there's just those problems, and that point I think is absolutely valid, the notion that you need to have some commitments, otherwise you can't do anything. Nevertheless, there's a difference between having those commitments also reinforced by ideological fervor because of their motivational power, and having those commitments as a cognitive intellectual project that defines the starting point for your theoretical work. Lakatos is talking about the latter. Marxism has both, and that's... There's a hand over here. Yeah.
But I would like to see this tension as a fruitful one. I mean, I think it's very subjective from person to person how to take on this tension. I mean, after Burovoy takes on this tension issue, he describes it as a dichotomy, and you correct him. I didn't put it as a dichotomy, but as a tension. But I think, personally, it very much talks to me, because I was part of a political group, for instance, and I was accused, a couple of friends, to give up with my commitments and go after the science. And it's like the dichotomy Borovoy raises, save the Marxism or to save the sociology. I think, could we say that it's a fruitful, because sometimes we see that we fall on that part of the tension, or sometimes we fall on the other part, but I don't think that we should accept one way and go after that and don't see, especially, I mean, for the people who are, who define themselves as Marxists, of course.
Yeah.
And half of the class define themselves as Marxists, don't very much in Marxist works.
What I can say with some confidence is that there's a tension here. I think what we hope to do is to make it a fruitful tension, as opposed to a demobilizing destructive tension. Historically, sometimes it's destructive and sometimes it's fruitful. It, you know, I think it's, it depends upon context and the nature of social struggles, whether this is a fruitful or a destructive tension between these two dimensions of this intellectual project. Yeah.
Yeah, I can see what you're saying, like, based on, okay, so I've read the reading and everything, and I understand, like, this idea that there's a tension, but to some degree, I don't understand it. Like, so for example, you're, like, what you're doing is you're creating the foundations for the idea. Like, but what's the definition of ideology, maybe, is a good question, because everybody probably needs some sort of ideology to act in the world and change it. So I would think that everybody has an ideology of some sort, and providing that base just makes those connections, backs the ideology up with facts in the real world. And you can have an ideology based on 100% factual information, can't you?
You can, sure. And the term ideology covers both the moral commitments that one holds, the values that are driving it, and the theory of the world you are using to put those values into place. They both get incorporated in the term ideology. Now, I feel I have a pretty unshakable ideology with respect to the moral core of a radical democratic egalitarian vision. I can't imagine a set of arguments that would convince me that there's something fundamentally wrong with those values with respect to my own sense of the world. So I do feel that there are, that aspect of ideology I have firmly in place. That is not sufficient, however, I think, to give you a course of action. Ideologies also then are prescriptive. They tell you what you need to do in the world in order to realize those ideologies. Now that's the part of the ideology which gets into the most tension with the scientific efforts, because the scientific effort says, can say things like, everything you do is going to blow up in your face if you try to do too much, because unintended consequences are so huge, and therefore you need to be very cautious. But your anger and rage at the world for its oppressiveness wants you to do something decisive. But you can't do something decisive without invoking the specter of massive unintended consequences that are going to wreak havoc with the world. And so you get kind of paralyzed on action. I'm just giving one scenario. You can get paralyzed in action because although your values are firm, your continual worries and skepticism about the translation of those values into action because of your theory about how the world works and its complexity block you from doing things that are decisive. And what activists want to do is to get people to act decisively, and so what they characteristically do is simplify drastically these problems and in ways that then motivate people to engage in help motivate people to engage in decisive action. Yeah.
So I think in that way, and building on what Kyle says a little bit, it could be argued that tension, while it can be, it can lead to a lot of hand-wringing stress over, am I going about this the right way? It can be fruitful. It seems to me like it's almost absolutely necessary to be there at all times. The greatest follies you see throughout history regarding this relationship happen when the tension goes away, when it disappears, when you either have, you know, all ideology,
right,
you have too much science. So at the same time, while it's very stressful, if you're careful about your methods and your words, as we are, if it's not there, then I think that's what, I think it's necessary. And if it's not there, you've got a big problem.
It's after 12. I think we do need to stop. Next time, though, and this is part of next week's discussion as well. And I will be especially disciplined in having the introductory comments short and punchy, so that we'll have plenty of time to explore these things. I'll be in my office this afternoon from 2 to 4. How many people would like me to run off copies of the syllabus, and I'll just do it? Raise your hands high. So I 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Okay, I'll make us 7 copies. They'll be in my office by 2:30 if you want to talk.
I'll see you on these guys.
Oh yeah, give me your name tags back.